Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
It is once again time for Unearthed. Since we started doing these quarterly, it kind of feels like it's always time for
I know, Unearthed. It does. When you had mentioned you were working on this one, I was like, no. Oh, yeah. It is time.
It is time. If you are brand new to the show, Unearthed is when we take a look at what has been literally or figuratively unearthed over the last few months. So this installment of Unearthed is about things that were unearthed in April, May, and June 2022. This installment, part one, we have updates and some jewelry and some auctions and some books and letters and some shipwrecks. And then in part two of this Unearthed on Wednesday, we'll have the edibles and potables and some art and some animals, other stuff too. Once again, we had two episodes worth of stuff. Looked a little doubtful for a while there, but,
but here
wound
we
up
are.
With two.
So the Black Death made a bunch of headlines in June after it was reported that researchers had conclusively determined the starting point of the second plague pandemic. That's the centuries-long pandemic that the Black Death was part of. This research was probably the biggest headline maker of all of the headlines in this particular installment of Unearthed.
As described in research that was published in the journal Nature, the team studied DNA in a burial site in modern Kyrgyzstan. That burial site has graves in it that date back to the year 1338. Archaeologists have actually known about this burial site and the years engraved on the markers for more than a century. What was not known was whether the people buried there actually died of plague. There's a word on these grave markers that has been translated as pest or as pestilence, and people do use that to mean plague a whole lot, but it could also mean any number of other diseases and conditions. So based on the time period and the way people talked and wrote about the plague, that seems like a pretty logical conclusion, so it makes sense that researchers were focused on this site.
This research did indeed confirm that the people buried at these grave sites died of plague. That, plus the years marked on the tombstones, means we know for sure that there were people who died of plague in 1338 and were buried at this location in modern Kyrgyzstan. But the paper and the reporting around it made it sound like a much broader discovery, with headlines like, "Origins of the Black Death Identified." That's actually the headline on a release from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, which was part of this work. But it was also all over mainstream news reporting with headlines like, "We finally know where the Black Death started."
This is definitely a case where I saw those headlines and I was like, did we though?
Are you sure?
You sure about that? I was not the only person with questions. People with far more qualifications to study that than me had questions also. Not everybody was sold on that conclusion. So, for example, Dr. Monica Green has written extensively on the Black Death and the Second Plague Pandemic. And on June 22nd, she put out a thread on Twitter about this paper. She noted which parts of it confirmed to what was already known, like the existence of this burial site and the tombstones in it, as well as what in this research builds onto that existing knowledge, like confirming that the pestilence that's referenced on those tombstones really was the plague and not something else.
She also looks at the DNA research that was done in the study in detail in a way that isn't really easy for us to capture as laypeople doing an audio podcast. It's about single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, pronounced SNPs. Those are basically genetic variations or mutations. Three of them are a key part in the evolutionary history of Yersinia pestis, and according to Green, the analysis in the paper only has really good coverage of one of them, while also showing a fourth SNP that seems to be new. This actually led to some back and forth on Twitter about whether that fourth SNP is really a false positive or not.
Beyond that, though, Green also notes that a lot of the more recent historical research into the plague and the Black Death and all of that has suggested that the origins are in the 13th century, not the 14th century where this research was focused. So in addition to these questions about the details of the DNA study, there's a whole century of history that's being omitted here. So in other words, the idea that this conclusively pinpoints the starting point for the Black Death, that seems like a much bigger claim than can really be supported by the details in this paper.
The Black Death has come up a lot on the show. There's a short episode on it from previous hosts back in 2009, but more recently, it was a big part of our episode on Wat Tyler and the uprising of 1381. That came out on June 10th, 2020.
Moving on, a team looking for evidence regarding the murder of Emmett Till found a warrant for the arrest of Carolyn Bryant Donham, named in the warrant as Mrs. Roy Bryant. That warrant dated back to August 29th, 1955. We talked about the lynching of Emmett Till in our episode, The Motherhood of Mamie Till Mobley, which came out August 28th, 2017. The team doing this research included members of the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation, and Deborah Watts, who is one of Till's cousins, is the head of the foundation. She and her daughter, Terry, were among the group of people who was searching for some kind of evidence here.
In addition to the earlier episode on Mamie Till Mobley, we have also talked about this case on previous installments of Unearthed. After the U.S. Department of Justice reopened the case in 2017, and then closed it again in 2021, saying that no new evidence had been discovered that could lead to an arrest of a living person. Carolyn Bryant Dunham is still living, and people involved with this case have expressed their hope that this old warrant could still be served.
People knew about this warrant back in 1955, but the LaFleur County Sheriff at the time told reporters that they didn't want to bother her. Her then-husband Roy Bryant and another man named J.W. Milam were tried for this crime and acquitted, but they confessed to the crime in an interview that they later sold to a reporter for $4,000. So there's been some discussion of whether this warrant could be the thing that, like, allows there to be some more progress on the case.
This next thing is not exactly an update, but it is related to an earlier episode topic. A statue of dancer Marjorie Tallchief was stolen from the vintage garden at the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum at the end of April. Marjorie was the sister of past podcast subject Maria Tallchief, who is another of the indigenous ballerinas honored with a statue at the garden. We covered Maria Tallchief on the show on November 3rd, 2014.
A few days after this theft was discovered, the Historical Society got a call from CMC Recycling, which buys scrap metal. And the recycling center was reporting that it had pieces of this statue. Somebody had cut it up into parts and then had sold the pieces to them as scrap.
The statues of Marjorie and Maria Tallchief are part of a work called Five Moons. This was the work of artists Monty England and Gary Henson. It honors five indigenous ballerinas from what's now Oklahoma. England died in 2005, and the original mold for the statue of Marjorie Tallchief was destroyed in a foundry fire. So while a fundraiser to replace the statue met its goal right away, it initially seemed like it would kind of be a challenge to actually make a replacement.
A bit later in May, though, additional pieces of the statue were recovered at another recycling center, including the head of the statue. And although there's some pieces that are still missing, Henson, who's a member of the Shawnee tribe, was quoted as saying, with the amount of the statue that's been recovered so far, he's confident that he's going to be able to restore it.
Previous hosts of the show talked about the Mary Rose in their episode Five Shipwreck Stories in 2011. The Mary Rose sank in 1545 and is now in the Mary Rose Museum. At the end of 2021, we talked about conservation efforts involving the Mary Rose, which involved pinpointing exactly where bacteria are living within the preserved wreckage, because secretions from those bacteria could become acidic when exposed to air, and that could cause the wreckage to deteriorate.
The hull of the ship itself is not the only part of this wreck that has been brought to the museum or is now facing some challenges with preservation. The Mary Rose had two brick ovens, and bricks from those ovens are also at the museum, and they're also being affected by acids.
When the bricks were recovered from the wreck site, they were washed and dried to remove the salt water that they had been soaking in for centuries. Conservators thought that the bricks were stable at that point, but more recently, salt crystals have started forming on them, suggesting that there is still something going on inside them that could be causing damage.
So researchers have been using a bunch of different imaging and analysis techniques to try to get a sense of both the physical and the chemical processes that might be at work here. This has involved examining the bricks themselves and the crystals that have been growing on them. And much like the way those bacterial secretions could become acidic when they're exposed to air, these salts seem to have created an acidic environment inside the bricks as they've dissolved.
One interesting part of all this is that the team didn't find evidence of sodium or chlorine, which are the key components of sea salt. That suggests that the original washing treatments on the bricks did remove sea salt as intended, but that these other salts were left behind.
Like the work that we previously discussed around the Mary Rose, this is a work in progress with the team trying to find ways to figure out what they should do next.
Let's take a quick sponsor break before we get back to another update of another shipwreck.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. The Clotilda has made a few appearances on Unearthed. This was the last vessel known to bring enslaved people into the United States, and then after that happened, its captain intentionally burned and sank it in the Mobile River in Alabama. This was in 1860, and that was almost 50 years after Congress passed the act prohibiting the importation of slaves. So that was illegal, but people were still doing it anyway. In previous episodes, we have talked about the discoveries of other wrecks that were believed to be the Clotilda. We also have talked about this one, which was confirmed to be the correct ship in 2019.
Researchers started making their first research dives to the wreck in May of this year. They've been studying and scanning the wreck itself and evaluating its integrity, as well as organisms living in the wreck, which play a part in its overall integrity. They have also been looking for and retrieving disarticulated pieces of the wreck.
Before setting fire to the Clotilda, the slave traffickers who were using it transferred everyone aboard onto a riverboat, so there should not have been any people on board when it sank, but the team is also looking for DNA evidence from the ship. They're doing that by collecting small core samples from the ship, and the hope is that they'll be able to connect people who were trafficked aboard this ship to their living descendants today.
And speaking of DNA, for the first time, scientists have sequenced the genome of someone who died at Pompeii after the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79. Researchers extracted DNA from two sets of remains that were found close to each other at a building called the House of the Craftsman. One appeared to be from a man between the ages of 35 and 40, and the other from a woman estimated to be about 50. But there were gaps in the woman's DNA sequence, so only the man's was used for this genome sequencing.
After comparing this DNA to that of more than 1,000 other ancient people and that of 471 people from Western Europe today, they found out this person had DNA similar to people living in Italy during the Roman era and to people who are living in modern Italy. That lines up with what you would expect based on this person being at Pompeii when it was destroyed. Then by examining his mitochondrial DNA, researchers also determined that he had some genes in common with people from Sardinia, which aren't also shared with people from other parts of Italy. So it seems like he had some ancestry there as well. And this gives us a glimpse into the possible diversity and mobility of people who were living in this part of the world almost 2,000 years ago.
The people who died at Pompeii were covered in ash, and that protected their DNA from some of the factors that would normally cause it to degrade over thousands of years. But even so, getting enough intact DNA to sequence a whole genome has been a very lengthy process.
Yeah, they've had lots of other attempts that have not worked out. In other Pompeii news, one of the latest finds there is a tortoise, either a wild tortoise from somewhere near the city or somebody's pet. This tortoise seems to have burrowed under some debris to lay her eggs. The tortoise was removed in stages and an egg was found still inside her body. So this tortoise was found under the remains of a building that had already been destroyed in the earthquake that happened shortly before everything else was destroyed in the volcanic eruption. Sometimes when you see things, people are like, oh, that's the remains of whatever animal. And you're like, is it really though? This, you look at the pictures and you're like, that's a tortoise right there.
There are still finds coming up from the Antikythera shipwreck as part of the Return to Antikythera project, including the head of a statue of Hercules. It's possible that this 2,000-year-old head is the one that goes on the body of a statue that sponge divers found in 1900 and which is now in the Athens National Archaeological Museum.
Other finds from this latest set of dives include some of the ship's equipment, including parts of the anchor, parts of a marble statue base, and some human teeth.
Maybe the Bell Witch put them there.
I was thinking about that.
Every time we talk about teeth, I think of her. And in our last update for now, Vindolanda has made several appearances on previous episodes of Unearthed. That's the Roman fort and settlement in Northumberland that's home to all kinds of ongoing archaeological work. And in May, the team at Vindolanda announced a new finding dating back to the 3rd century. A large piece of stone carved with a phallus and engraved with the words Secundinus Cacor, which we will translate approximately to Secundinus the Pooper.
Yeah, most articles about this translate with the word that's a little more stronger than pooper. Phalluses were often used as a symbol of good luck at this place and time. There are lots of phallus engravings around. This one, though, seems more clearly meant as an insult. Somebody did not like that guy.
I like that we found essentially like very intensely created insult graffiti.
Yeah, that's basically what that is.
Moving on, we have a few pieces of jewelry and clothing and similar items. You know those best friend necklaces that are made to resemble a broken heart where one friend wears half and the other friend wears the other? Tracy might have thought these didn't still exist. They do, I assure you. You can even get Star Wars ones.
Yeah, I just associate them with being 13 in the early, decades ago. So I was like, is that still even a thing?
That's just the last time you encountered them, perhaps, but they are still out there doing the rounds. Postdoctoral researcher Marja Ahola from the University of Helsinki has been examining slate ring ornaments that may have been put to similar use about 6,000 years ago.
So there are a lot of these rings in the archaeological record, but for the most part, they have not been found intact. And that is not really surprising. A lot of stuff in the archaeological record is broken, and these are small slate rings that are thousands of years old, so would not necessarily expect a lot of them to be whole at this point. But Ahola's research suggests that these did not just break through wear or handling or everything associated with the passage of all that time, that instead, at least some of them were broken intentionally and then possibly used to maintain or signify relationships within a community. So one person gets one piece and one person gets the other piece.
This research involved a whole group from the University of Helsinki and the University of Turku, and they matched up the pieces of these rings and analyzed their geochemical composition. And they found that in some cases, different parts of the same ring had been found in two different locations. Some of the rings were also found hundreds of kilometers from where they were made, again, suggesting that they were playing some role within a large interconnected community network.
Moving on, what may be the oldest prayer beads so far found in Britain have been unearthed on the island of Lindisfarne. These were found near the neck of some skeletal remains that may have belonged to a monk, and it's likely that they were strung together and worn, although if that's the case, the string itself is no longer there, which again is not very surprising. They're made from salmon vertebrae, and the holes through the vertebrae, which are naturally occurring as part of their anatomy, those holes have been enlarged, either intentionally or as a side effect of their having been worn on a string. These date back to the 8th or 9th century, and I just think the idea of having your prayer beads made out of fish vertebrae, like, that's cool.
Well, it makes me envision a future craft project, is what it makes me do. I'm like, how? Well, what do you have to do to sterilize those guys? Let's talk about this. Next up, a hiker in Norway spotted a sandal sticking out of melting ice in 2019. The hiker got in touch with a glacial archaeology program called Secrets of the Ice, and a team went to investigate. They got to the site in time to excavate the sandal and several other items before a snowstorm covered it all back up.
Since that time, the team from Secrets of the Ice has made a replica of the sandal, which resembles a Roman lace-up sandal called a carbatina. Then raised some questions about that seems like not very adequate footwear for a frozen, snowy place. There was a suggestion that maybe they were worn with socks. They've also done some radiocarbon dating and confirmed that the sandal dates back to the 4th century, meaning that the mountain pass where this was found was already in use by that point.
Most recently, the sandal has been part of a report from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology about discoveries like this one, which are revealed as glaciers melt, and how a lack of funding and monitoring is preventing researchers from being able to find and retrieve many of these kinds of objects before they thaw out and are destroyed.
And in our last jewelry find, a man plowing a field in Turkey, also known as Turkey, plowed up a 3,300-year-old bracelet. He took this bracelet to the Çorum Museum, which restored it and confirmed that it came from the Hittite civilization.
Although this region was home to the capital of the Hittite civilization, there haven't been many pieces of Hittite jewelry found. So this discovery is helping researchers get more of a sense of its jewelry styles and jewelry making techniques. This one is kind of like a large bangle made of bronze, silver, and gold, and it's decorated with Hittite symbols and figures.
We're going to take a quick sponsor break and then talk about some things that showed up at auction. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. Next up, we have a few notable items that have gone up for auction over the last few months. First, a violin made by Antonio Stradivari in 1714 called the Da Vinci ex Seidel violin sold at auction in June for $15.9 million. I don't know why I felt the need to say it that dramatically. It's
a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but also in line with the amount of money that a person would expect to see for a Stradivarius violin. This instrument was given the Da Vinci nickname in the 1920s, and the ex Seidel denotes that it previously belonged to Tosha Seidel. Tosha Seidel was a virtuoso violinist who played this instrument in orchestral performances and on film scores. It may have been included in the score to The Wizard of Oz. That's sort of like there's some conjecture involved there, because he definitely recorded violin music for a number of film scores and was working for MGM around the time that that score was recorded. But his involvement is not specifically noted anywhere. Is, though, included in a lot of other film scores from around that time.
In our next auction, a medal commemorating General Daniel Morgan and his victory at the Battle of Cowpens during the American Revolution has been sold at auction for almost $1 million. Apart from the record-setting price tag, before the medal appeared at auction, it was believed to be lost.
Yeah, this medal was originally part of a series of 133 medals called the Comida Americana. The United States commissioned French artists to create these medals between 1776 and the early 19th century. They all commemorate notable people and events from the Revolutionary War. The Morgan Medal was designed by Augustin Dupré, and it was struck in Paris in 1789. When General Morgan died in 1802, his grandson, Morgan Lafayette Neville, inherited this medal, but then it was stolen from the bank where he worked as a cashier in 1818. In addition to the medal, the thieves stole more than $100,000 and some gold and silver and other metals from the bank vaults. This was part of a big bank heist.
Although these thieves were apprehended and one of them helped authorities recover most of the stolen goods, the original Morgan medal was among the items that were never found. One of the thieves claimed that it had been in a bag that was dropped into the Ohio River. So Congress approved a replacement medal to be made at the Philadelphia Mint, and that was given to General Morgan's great-grandson in 1841.
That's not the end of this saga, though. J.P. Morgan bought the medal in the 1880s, which for some reason, when I got to that part in the story, I went, "Oh man," out loud. Like, I don't... J.P. Morgan bought other stuff that did not then get destroyed somehow, but Morgan believed incorrectly that he was related to General Daniel Morgan, and at some point after he bought the medal, it disappeared. It was believed to have been lost or melted down until an anonymous person consigned it to auction house Stax Bowers, just seemingly out of nowhere.
The buyer, who spent $960,000 on it, that's a bid of $800,000 plus a 20% buyer's premium, is also anonymous, but an executive from the auction house has publicly maintained that it has, quote, gone to a good home.
I don't know what that is meant to mean.
They're going to make sure it gets proper nutrition and vet visits. Yeah, I don't know.
I keep reading it like it was, they sent the medal to live on a farm upstate. Anyway, next. A tiny book of poems by Charlotte Bronte was sold at auction in April. This tiny book had last been sold at auction in 1916, and after that point, it seemed to disappear until somebody found it in an envelope that was tucked inside a 19th century book. This was the last of her known tiny books to be in private hands. We've talked about these tiny Charlotte Bronte books and the other Bronte's tiny books at various points in the show before.
Yeah. Bronte wrote the poems when she was about 13, and she made them into a book by hand, sewing it together with a needle and thread. The book is 15 pages long, and it contains 10 poems, and it is titled A Book of Rhymes by Charlotte Bronte, Sold by Nobody and Printed by Herself. The word rhymes is misspelled, with the H and the Y transposed. As far as we know, these are the only previously unpublished poems by Charlotte Bronte.
I find that flip of the H and the Y really charming. When the sale of this tiny book was originally publicized, the buyer was anonymous, so there was, of course, some level of upset by people who felt like that this should be in a museum. A few days later, though, it was announced that the purchaser was the Friends of the National Libraries, who bought it for $1.25 million and is donating it to the Bronte Parsonage Museum.
I have thoughts about giant auctions and anonymity that we will talk about on Friday.
Okay.
Maybe. And lastly, Sotheby's will be auctioning off a 399-year-old copy of Shakespeare's First Folio on July 7th. That's after we record this, but it is before the episode will come out. 235 of the 750 copies that were originally made of the First Folio are still known to exist today, but fewer than 20 are in private collections, so one showing up at auction really doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, we may have another update on this later on in a future installment of Unearthed. Those last couple of auctions could also have been filed under Books and Letters, and that's what we're turning to next. According to research published in Advances in Space Research, researchers have found the oldest known written record of an aurora. This was in a Chinese text called the Bamboo Annals, which date back to about the 10th century BCE. This describes a multicolored light in the sky during the reign of King Zhao, who was the fourth king of the Zhou dynasty.
This paper is about more than just the existence of the document and a possible description of an aurora in it. It tries to calculate exactly where this observation happened, and more precisely when, concluding that the phenomenon was observed near the ancient settlement of Haojing sometime in 977 or 957 BCE, plus or minus a year.
Reporting about this makes it sound way more conclusive than the paper itself seems to. So the headlines say things like earliest description of aurora found, while the paper describes this more as a candidate for the earliest description of an aurora. And the paper also notes that earlier interpretations of exactly what was observed and where that observation was made have been kind of controversial.
I love how we have so many stories that are like, well, the headline.
The headline says this.
That's not what the actual contents reveal. Moving on March 9th, an anonymous person returned two missing notebooks belonging to Charles Darwin to the Cambridge University Library, along with a note that read, "Librarian, happy Easter, X." But we would have needed a time machine to have talked about this on our previous installment of Unearthed because it wasn't announced until April, which was after the spring Unearthed episodes were written and recorded.
The Cambridge University Library had put out a public appeal for the return of the notebooks in November of 2020. After realizing that these books, they were not just misplaced, they were actually missing from the library. They had been removed from the shelf where they normally lived in 2000 so they could be photographed. And then in early 2001, somebody discovered that the notebooks had not been put back where they were supposed to go. At first, the staff just thought they had been misplaced somewhere, like they had been put on the wrong shelf or something. That's kind of a running theme on Unearthed. There have been various points where we've talked about people finding things in their own collection because it had just been put in the wrong spot. When the library realized that the notebooks were really gone, they were not in the library anymore, they reported it to the police. That police report was made in October of 2020.
These notebooks are from after Darwin returned from his voyage aboard the Beagle, and one of them includes the famous Tree of Life sketch that illustrates his thought process as he was working through the idea that would later become part of his landmark work on the origin of species.
According to news reporting, when this was announced, a police investigation was still ongoing. The notebooks were left in a pink gift bag, and they were wrapped up in plastic wrap, and they were in a part of the library that isn't covered by security cameras. Now that these have been found, the library was planning to put them on display in an exhibit called Darwin in Conversation that's scheduled to open on July 9th. Again, that is after this episode is being recorded, but before it will actually come out.
Speaking of returned books, an original manuscript by Nostradamus disappeared from the Barnabiti Center for Historical Studies in Rome sometime around 2007 and was presumably stolen. It resurfaced last year when an art dealer tried to auction it off. Apparently, it had moved through a series of flea markets before showing up on the German auction house website, and that is when authorities spotted it.
This manuscript is about 500 pages long, and one of those pages is marked with a stamp from 1991, which is what allowed investigators to conclusively trace it back to the library, rather than thinking maybe it was a different copy of the same book. It was returned to the library in May.
And for our last thing under books and letters, during COVID lockdowns, the Leeds Central Library surveyed its rare books and special collections. During this process, they found about 3,000 items that, for one reason or another, had not been cataloged. One was a tiny, tiny Bible containing the Old and New Testaments.
This is a teeny, teeny version of the Great Bible of 1539, which was nicknamed the Chained Bible because there was supposed to be one in each church where it would be chained to the pulpit to keep people from walking away with it. It was supposed to make the Bible more accessible to people, but not so accessible that you could take it out of the church. That chained Bible was pretty big. This is the opposite. Its type is so small that it has to be read with a magnifying glass. The library is actually not sure where it came from or how it came to be in their collections.
I have theories already.
We can talk about that on Friday, too.
I'm making a note so I don't forget. It's time for shipwrecks, everybody's favorite. Hooray! Construction workers in Tallinn, Estonia, have found the wreck of a cog believed to have belonged to the Hanseatic League. It was found under a street, under about 5 feet of earth, in an area that used to be covered in water.
This cog is about 80 feet long and made of oak, with the spaces in between the planks sealed with tar and animal hair. It's been dated to the end of the 13th century, and things like shoes, packing material, and tools have also been found nearby.
As of April, there wasn't a clear plan for the wreck. Because of its size, if it's going to be moved, it has to be moved in pieces. But it was found during construction of a new office building, and that construction has been delayed by a couple of months because of this shipwreck find.
Next, the government of Colombia has released photos of the wreck of the San Jose, which sank off of Cartagena in 1708. This ship was part of a convoy of merchant vessels and was carrying goods that are estimated to be worth billions of dollars today. These photos were taken over a series of studies of the wreck using remotely operated vehicles, and they show that the ship is still full of things like pottery, glassware, and gold. It's believed to contain at least 2 tons of precious metals and gemstones.
Two other wrecks were discovered as part of this work, described as a colonial-era galleon and a schooner from the post-colonial period.
There is ongoing debate about who can claim the wreck of the San Jose. It was a Spanish ship, so Spain says that's ours, but it was found off the coast of Colombia. Colombia's like, that gives us dibs on it. A lot of the precious metals aboard, though, were mined by the Cojara people whose homeland is in what's now Bolivia.
Lots of people with claims on it. Back in 2007, divers in international waters off the coast of Great Yarmouth, Norfolk, found a cannon from a shipwreck that they believed to be the HMS Gloucester. The ship's identity was confirmed when its bell was brought up to the surface in 2012. But the discovery of the ship itself wasn't announced until June of this year for security reasons. Because it was in international waters, authorities needed time to secure the site.
Gloucester ran aground in 1682 with the Duke of York on board, and that Duke of York later became James II and VII. In the words of Professor Clara Jowett, the University of East Anglia, quote, "Because of the circumstances of its sinking, this can be claimed as the single most significant historic maritime discovery since the raising of the Mary Rose in 1982.
Although the Duke and more than 300 people aboard survived this wreck, hundreds of other passengers and crew did not. At this point, researchers haven't found any human remains at the wreck site, but they have found things like clothing, equipment, and wine bottles. An exhibition is planned for some of the items that have been recovered. That is set to start in the spring of 2023.
Next, archaeologists have found a 1,300-year-old shipwreck in a stream outside of Bordeaux, France. This seems to have been a cargo ship that was capable of navigating both rivers and coastal waters. This wreck is being removed for further study. There aren't a lot of records about exactly how ships were built in this particular time and place, so this find is an important source of information on that. And its removal is a feat. It's about 12 meters long, and it has to be cleared of sediment and mapped and documented, and then every piece of wood is being individually numbered and moved. It's a whole process.
And our last shipwreck of this installment of Unearthed. A shipwreck in the Philippines has been identified as the destroyer USS Samuel B. Roberts, which sank in battle in 1944. It was found at a depth of 6,985 meters, that's 22,916 feet, and that is more than 4 miles, making it the deepest shipwreck ever discovered. According to a statement by retired admiral and naval historian Samuel J. Cox, the site is a hallowed war grave. 89 of its crew of 224 were killed when the ship went down.
So that's it for part one of this installment of Unearthed, and we'll be back on Wednesday with some more finds.
You got a little listener mail?
I do. I have listener mail from Michelle, whose title for the email was West Wing Not Compulsory, But Perhaps Terry Pratchett Is. And Michelle wrote, "Hi, amazing women. I've been listening since Christmas 2020, starting at the beginning, and earned the Stuff You Missed in History Class PhD sometime last year. It's been great listening to all the podcasts. When I'm mowing the lawn, walking, crocheting, or running when it's not too hot, I live in Darwin in the Northern Territory, Australia, tropics. As soon as I saw the title of the last episode, Mercator, I immediately thought of the West Wing episode clip and the characters trying to turn their heads upside down to understand the map when it was reversed. I was wondering if you had mentioned the episode. I didn't think you would, since in other episodes I've thought, this is referenced in the West Wing, but you haven't mentioned it. And given that I'm the same age as Tracy and love Terry Pratchett, I wondered if this mystery would ever be solved. And today it was. Tracy hasn't watched the West Wing. What an obvious answer. And don't worry, I'm not telling you to watch the show. I am saying your photos on the iHeartRadio episode are fantastic, and I love the photo of you both in dress-up on the Facebook page. My friends and I call that open-mouth type of photo a Muppet photo. My wedding photos look like that. Thanks for your fine work. Michelle goes on to suggest some episode topics related to First Nations history from Australia, and then has some animal pictures. Which the first is a frilled neck lizard from around where Michelle lives. And this particular picture, when I saw, for some reason, my brain was like, that looks like a lizard. But the head of this lizard does not make any sense to me. I think because, like, I had not really thought through the frilled neck aspect of it. And then we have lots of adorable dog pictures. So thank you so much for these pictures. As for topic suggestions, one piece of complexity involving First Nations history related to Australia is that some of the cultures involved have cultural taboos regarding death and using the names of people who have died. And that sort of adds a piece of complexity and like how we would approach and talk about those episodes and what we would need to do regarding that. So thank you for these suggestions. That is an aspect of thinking through how we might would incorporate them. So thank you again for this this story and these animal pictures. I sure do love Terry Pratchett, and I'm glad to have solved the mystery that I have not watched any episode of The West Wing all the way through. I have only seen, I don't even know, I think it just like, I think something about the Mercator projection floated that clip up to the top of my YouTube feed somehow. Like, that is where saw it was on YouTube. So that's why I've never mentioned The West Wing. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, or historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We're also all over social media at Miss in History. That's where you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing.
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.